You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for coming. My name is Daniel Wolf, and I direct our work on harm reduction in the public health program. And I'm very pleased to welcome you to tonight's event on Drugs and the Dark Net, Opportunities and Challenges for Harm Reduction. Maybe just a few words of context and introduction. As some of you may know, the first transaction on the internet was actually a drug deal. It was a marijuana exchange between some graduate students at Stanford and their colleagues at MIT. And more generally, the internet's offer of relative anonymity, or at least pseudonymity and privacy, whether that's perceived or real, has from the start been a critical component of its development and one of its big draws. You know, people have used it to ask embarrassing questions, to procure pornography, to deliver reviews under a name that they wouldn't want to put their real name to. And when it comes to illicit drugs, exchange of information has been as critical as the purchase of drugs themselves. Thus, the thousands of posts on recipes for drugs or use of so-called research chemicals, the trip reports on new substances and old that you can find, the strategies for manufacture, use, and protection from harm. Some of us are old enough to remember some of the early discussion groups. I don't know how old everyone is, but I remember the alt.drugs groups. Some people have probably seen Blue Light or Reddit, where there are literally hundreds of thousands of posts containing information about drugs, their effects, and how to make them safer. The creation of the so-called onion router Tor in 2002, the development of, you know, that is basically routes internet traffic through thousands of relays, so it makes it very difficult to ascertain where the person is located. The creation of anonymized or almost anonymized digital currencies like Bitcoin in 2008, that allowed people to pay and vendors to receive without being identified, without any central authority or record. All of this took the drugs market and the internet to a new level, and brings us to tonight's panel. So Nab Dasgupta and Mike Gilbert are both experts in medicines and drugs, licit and illicit. Nab is an epidemiologist, a pharmacoepidemiologist, who has worked to reduce the adverse events associated with medicine use through collaboration with state and local health departments, the pharmaceutical industry, the World Health Organization, and maybe perhaps most importantly for our discussion here tonight with the Harm Reduction Coalition, which he is the chair of the board of. He's a researcher at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he has appointments at the Injury Prevention Research Center and the Eshelman School of Pharmacy. Mike Gilbert is a public health technologist, a phrase I have not heard before tonight, with a specialization in epidemiology and harm reduction. He's a graduate of the Harvard School of Public Health. He's published peer-reviewed papers on topics ranging from community-based naloxone distribution to non-medical use of antidepressants. He has a long history of working both with harm reduction programs on the ground, whether that's in Boston or the Bay Area or Portland, but also on the design of tools for research on how and why people use drugs, a topic of particular importance and which really needs more attention in this age of great concern about America's opioid overdose, which tends to attribute all of the power and attention to opioids and relatively little to the people who use them. Both Mike and Nab have for years looked into, and I don't want to say monitored, but maybe they would, online discussions about sales of opioids, and have designed cutting-edge research tools to look at mainstream media and social media, and analyzed how trends in these fora interact with use on the ground, and how policies around drugs, drug use, and information about drugs interact with that use. They are very much pharmacoepidemiological insiders, and I have to admit that when I first shared the description of the panel that they proposed with some of my informed colleagues at OSF, they admitted that they had no idea what the description was talking about. And I think that reflects both the OSF information technology people's success in blocking us from things like the dark web. And if any of you are using the guest Wi-Fi, you'll notice that all access to websites with drugs in the name are also blocked. But also to how the web, and in particular the dark web, creates these kind of microcultures and markets, which may be really unknown to many people who are not part of them and are certainly unfamiliar to those of us who aren't used to using Tor and who basically, for whom this world has remained closed. As our speakers tonight will show, when it comes to drugs, the dark web has come to play a large role both in the wholesale trade, and I recommend to you their article, which is on the table in the back, or as you enter the room. That's called Silicon to Syringe, Crypto Markets and Disruptive Innovation in Opioid Supply Chains. But as they will also talk to us and tell us, these markets have a potential role to play in reducing harms and reducing harmful effects of drugs that people choose to use. So that will be the subject of our discussion. I think we will probably learn some things, at least that most of us are not familiar with. So I encourage you, if something is not clear, please raise your hand. There is a blizzard of unfamiliar initials and sort of new concepts that these guys take for granted because they're so used to working in it. And I'm very glad to welcome you to the podium.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. We're really excited to be here and share some ideas and hopefully learn some new stuff ourselves. So we do want to start with a little bit of history. As Daniel mentioned, since there has been an internet, people have been using it to arrange transactions involving drugs. Initially, that took the form of forums. People were able to communicate with each other, ask questions openly that they might not sort of breach amongst their friends. There were a couple of decades of time when these forums proliferated, specialized, and developed policies around things like the discussion of sourcing of drugs. You could talk about the drugs, but not about where to get the drugs. And then there was the sort of a confluence of technologies and concepts in the sort of end of the first decade of the millennium, around where tools like the Tor network, which I'll spare the technical details, but it's a web browser that allows you to access a web server without them knowing your location and without your knowing their location, combined with peer-to-peer encryption technology, which let you send them a message that could only be read by the intended recipient, along with the emergence of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and the others that have followed. Those sort of three fundamental technologies stacked on top of forums with the sort of social concept of e-commerce, the willingness to send somebody money on the internet in exchange for items that they would send to you, sort of created the environment in which crypto markets or darknet markets first emerged. The role that the markets played was sort of filling a gap that hadn't been well served within some of the forums. Within forums, you might have people who were openly vending products, and there would be reviews of those products. But as consumer expectations started to shift, where we wanted to have a star rating for somebody, or we wanted to be able to browse listings, wanted to be able to see prices, maybe make transactions, have an account, and sort of use all of the tools that are sort of new sort of digital social networks allowed, this sort of new concept of the crypto market was born. And so rather, again, than describing in excruciating technical detail how these things work, we want to do a little bit of an exercise for which we're going to essentially role play through how these markets work. So I think understanding the mechanics of a transaction is the best way to understand each stakeholder's relationship to the system, opportunities for disruption in the system, and then we can talk about what what's really happened when those disruptions occur. So I've got a little baggie here of that's going to stand in for some esoteric substance, and I've got a...
It's not real.
It's not real. And this is also not real. Well, it is real, but it's an academic pentathlon medal from middle school, which is going to stand in for a Bitcoin. And so we're going to need a buyer, a vendor, a market, and a mail carrier. Do I have any volunteers? So would you like to be our buyer?
Sure.
All right. So I'm gonna hand you this. And let's see, just based on where you're laid out, would you like to be our vendor?
Sure.
All right, so you are in possession of this, which means you're going to be our market admin, and you're going to help us deliver the drugs.
Okay.
All right, great, wonderful. All right, so within this arrangement, you've decided that you want to create a forum in which people can, you know, buy or sell whatever they want. You'll take a 3% commission on the sale. If people want to sell products on your market, they'll have to give you a little bit of a vendor bond, you know, $500 to show that they're earnest and to make sure that they don't just take a bunch of people's money and run. And so you set up a website where, you know, using some sort of commodity scripts that you can, you know, get just about anywhere, essentially like an eBay clone, call it. Now you see this website and you think, well, hey, I've got these drugs, see, and I'd kind of like some money, you know, for them. And so you would approach the market and you'd say, I'd like to put a listing on the market. You'd pay your vendor bond, right? And you'd put up some listings. Say, you know, even let's just call it a single listing for 8 grams of that powder. Now you're interested in some powder, right? Right. So at this point, you understand that there's this market. And you know that if you want to get anything from the market, you're going to have to get some Bitcoin, some Ethereum, some Monero, some name your cryptocurrency. And so you did it. You know, you probably took some precautions to make sure your name wasn't attached to it. You know, you didn't like go on Coinbase and put in your credit card and get the money. Or if you did, you probably went through some other, you know, tools to separate your identity from, you know, the provenance and use of that coin. And so now you've got coin and you've got drugs and you've got a market. So what you're going to do is you're going to approach the market. And you're going to say, I'd like some drugs, please, and from this person. And what you're going to do is you're going to give the market your coin. And so you can actually, yes, physically give the market your coin. And now the market is going to tell the vendor, hey, this guy wants some of those drugs. You know, you might send your address in an encrypted format to the vendor there. The vendor is going to then... package them up ever so stealthily and hand them to the mail carrier, who will, unbeknownst to the mail carrier, likely, who knows, deliver them to our buyer. Now you would tell the market, I got my drugs, great, at which point the market releases the coin to the vendor. And scene. So that is a sort of normative process for how crypto markets would work. The market acts as an escrow and as sort of a intermediary so that the vendor doesn't have to go to the trouble of, say, creating their own website. The buyer is insulated from just sending their money to the vendor directly because there's this intermediary process, right? And the post office gets paid just like they do for any other package, right? And occasionally a package opens up and a mail person, you know, sees what's inside and maybe they, you know, catch a whiff of it or whatever.
And then there's a ranking system.
Yeah, yeah. So, yes, exactly, importantly. So now you've received these products and you either loved them, hated them, whatever you think about them, you put that out onto the forums, say. You know, you might write a review. And you might put a review specifically on the market. And so this vendor is going to develop reputation. And now you, as a buyer, you're also going to develop reputation. So, you know, on your profile, the vendor might say, yes, this person, sent me their address in an encrypted format. They, you know, promptly finalized payment upon receipt of the product. And so there's this sort of reputation function that operates for all parties. There's also a reputation function for the market, because you're maybe not the only market. At any given time, there are any number of markets. You know, early on, there was the Silk Road and a couple of others. As each successive market was closed for some reasons that we're about to explore, new ones popped up and competed for market share, and some of them were deemed more or less trustworthy, than others. Yeah, precisely. So the market acts as the central sort of forum, but I'm not using that in the sense of a discussion forum, through which the vendor and the buyer can communicate.
Yep, and the markets could be language specific. So if you were only a Russian speaker, then you could have a Russian only market. And then the total time for this transaction could be on the order of a day. You know, you can go from buying Bitcoin to placing the order, having it overnight shipped, and you would have it the next day.
Mm-hmm. And you know, similarly, the market could decide we're only going to be a market for cannabis and psychedelics, or we are only going to be a market for vendors who have proven their reliability through prior experience. And so you may have some policies that you implement that might change the way that people select your market versus another.
All right. The drugs get lost in the mail.
Well, so let's run a little scenario. All right, so let's reset. Let's reset just so that everybody is clear on there, just so we can keep our roles straight. All right, so now the market is up. You would place an order. So let's say the coin goes to the market. Now let's say the market communicates to the vendor, hey, this guy wants some drugs. The product go into the mail. And then the mail carrier is delivering them, and oops, I'm a cop, and I caught you. And now we have a dispute. How do we know that you sent the drug? How do we know that you sent the product?
Shipping number.
If there was a shipping number involved, that would be great. Getting a shipping number is a little bit of a challenging prospect if you're trying to keep your identity clear from the United States Postal Service. There are means, by which this can be done, but this could be a challenge. And how is this indistinguishable? How is this distinguishable from a case in which I didn't intervene in it and you got them and just said they never showed up? So in this case, we have an arbiter. You have a mediator who will, say, listen to either side. If you can provide a shipping label, and you can say, check the tracking on this, it left this place at this time and got there, then maybe that's some evidence. Maybe you sent an empty package, or there are any number of things that could have happened. Or maybe you just have a dispute with the quality of the product. They said it was really strong and it's not. That's another dispute that you're going to have to now judge on. You're going to have to decide who is going to hold that coin. And you can decide in any number of ways. And those have been responded to in a couple of ways that we'll discuss a little later. But let's do one more scenario. All right? So here, reset real quick.
And for those who are standing, you're welcome to stand, but there are seats up in front and we won't penalize you if you come and take them.
All right, so starting again from the top, you'd like to make an order. So you're going to give this person your coin. And now,
this is all online, right?
This is all online. This is all through an e-commerce website that looks like any other shop that you might buy on, like an eBay or an Etsy or what have you.
So no verification who that the buyer is?
No. They are an online persona. They are a name and, in some dimensions, an internet, a network location. Now, say at this point, you're holding that coin. Now, this isn't the only transaction that happened today. And there's a lag between the time when, the person sends you the coin and the vendor sends the product. And say in that time, you've amassed, 40,000 Bitcoin. And Bitcoin are worth about $11,000 today each. And so you might decide, I'm out. Like, thanks, everybody. I'm done. And you've been holding that coin. And so, you're holding coin. You have control over it because you are the trusted arbiter, in this interaction. And now, as has happened in past markets, you have had a market scam in which you get away with all the money and everybody else is bummed. Similarly, you could have a situation in which you, as a vendor, have a policy that says, for newer buyers, I'm going to insist that you finalize early. I don't necessarily trust your judgment of whether your attestation of having received these products or your evaluation of these products. You want to make sure that you get paid when the product leaves your hands, because you can't trust everybody on the internet. And, but in this situation, so now you've asked them to finalize early and you being a relatively new person to these markets say, okay, I'll agree. I really want the product. I can't find it in my area. I'm willing to do this. And now he's not the only person who's finalized early. And now you're holding all the coin and the product. And now you can run off into the night, and which would be referred to as a vendor scam. Of course, there's another sort of looming issue here, which is, what happens if we back up just a little bit where the market is still holding the coin? And I've been buying things a whole bunch on the market, and I've been sort of watching the, patterns of network traffic coming through the market. I've been, studying the sort of behaviors of the market administrators online. I've been doing penetration testing and finding vulnerabilities in your site where I can inject code and find out the network location where you're operating and maybe where you're accessing, that server from. And as has happened a number of times, I might just come and arrest the market operator. In which case, if there are coin and drugs in play, again, everybody's real bummed and the market is gone. And then there will be another. So rinse and repeat. Each time a market goes down, several new markets emerge, and people just keep playing the game over and over. But there are innovations in the game. Like there are technological tools that can help to solve some of these problems. One of the problems might be your concern about connecting this currency and the acquisition of the currency to your name. One of your problems might be having all this cryptocurrency and wanting some cash, and how do you get it out of a digital format and into bills in your hand? There are coins that don't use, perfectly and openly transparent blockchains where, you can't trace each transaction from wallet to wallet to wallet as one can with Bitcoin. So there are innovations in terms of new cryptocurrencies that help to protect the transition of cash into crypto and crypto back into cash. There are multi-signature transactions. Like, say, instead of you having all the power in this situation to move the funds from the buyer to the vendor, you could have a situation in which two of the three of you have to agree to finalize the transaction. In which case, if the market gets taken out of the picture, the buyer and the vendor can still reconcile between themselves. If the vendor has a problem, the two of you can finalize as well. So those are a couple of technological innovations, that help with these things. Now, there's also another, as I said, these markets are vulnerable. They're fairly complex. Sometimes people set them up without understanding all of the ins and outs of the technology. And so at a certain point, once you two have done business enough, well, maybe you just cut the market out of it. And you just say, okay, I trust you, vendor. I've purchased from you a number of times. You seem to be a reputable person. And now you just have a decentralized system in which you don't have to go through the markets. Now you're just sending encrypted emails, say, from one account to another, cutting the markets out entirely and not mingling your transactions with this high volume of people transacting in any variety of products at any scale. So are there any other scenarios that we want to run? I think that's a pretty good synopsis of the various different, of how it should go, how it has gone, and what people have kind of done to try and mitigate the risks for each stakeholder in that process. All right. On to the harm reduction parts.
Thank you.
Here, I'll take the coin. Yes.
Red is on. Okay. That's logical. So there's a lot of questions about how harm reduction can operate within this sphere, right? So there's a lot of hype about the scope of what crypto markets can do for harm reduction, and there's a lot of promise as well. So some of the most important things are being able to have quality and safety checks on the product. So a lot of the markets and ancillary websites and other services will allow for checking of the quality and the potency, the purity, contamination, and other elements of what is being sold on the markets. And there are ways to feed that back into the market, so there's some kind of verification of what's in a bag. And that seems like a very important and central way to reduce the harms of illicitly manufactured drugs.
Yeah. And so, you know, that concept of, you know, product quality, safety, sort of transparency in the transaction, and sort of mutual and peer support amongst the people who are interacting in the market is important. And I'm going to offer a couple of points not to refute, but to sort of temper that aim, how we understand the sort of harm reduction through the improvement of quality and informed consumption. One of those would be that, you know, despite this, counterfeiting is fairly rampant on the markets. There's a lot of buyer beware mentality where, you know, people are selling something where the top of the title says these are Roxy 30s, and then, you know, in smaller print below, in a big block of text, it says these have 0.8 milligrams of fentanyl per pill. You know, they're not actually oxycodone. They're not actually what they are. So there's a little bit of a literacy element, like a digital literacy conventional literacy, I guess, element of knowing where to look and being able to interpret the content that one finds there. There's also a little bit of an issue, like say you are able to buy, you know, pure, potent drugs, you know, maybe, you know, the heroin that's available in your area is saturated with fentanyl. Like, you know, you can't find a bag of diamorphine or diacetylmorphine anywhere in your region. Being able to access new drug, you know, that drug through the markets might be important. But one of the challenges to that is now you've got access to all of these drugs. Yes, you can get the drug that you want, but to cite the name, one of my favorite academic publication names ever, you know, what if you live above a bakery and you love cakes? You know, what if, like, and there's, so, which explored the sort of natural history of people's use of these sites, in which they describe the sort of branching out of their drug use to use drugs they might not otherwise have access to. They might not have peer support networks. Like, these drugs might not be familiar to them or the people in their area. Their friends might not know how to respond to somebody who's having a crisis or an emergency, just because they're either new or unfamiliar in the context.
But what if in that process you find something that's maybe less potent, maybe gives you mm-hmm. more functional ability that you are looking for, and maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah, well, if you're looking for ketamine but you can't really find it, and you find methoxetamine, and you're like, oh, this is a little milder, a little longer acting, and it has like a pleasant sweet sensation in my nose, maybe that's superior. And then, when it comes to the attestation of purity, these are also gameable systems. So, we're talking about drug checking here, where somebody submits a sample to a lab that runs GCMS and, does a sort of formal qualification of what's in that sample. If I'm the vendor, I can send a sample of known high quality, submit that to the lab, and then say, here are the results for my product, when the stuff that I'm actually shipping isn't that. There are a number of other sort of problems that have yet to be addressed within that sort of reputation and information economy that I think probably should be addressed, and that are explicitly identified by the people operating most pill testing or most drug checking services, where they say, these results are applicable only to the sample submitted. They're not extensible to the rest of this batch. They're not extensible to the rest of this vendor's product. They're not extensible to other things that look, smell, or are priced like this.
Okay, I believe all that, fine. But these drugs are good, these will work, these are fine. But you know what, no one gets stabbed on the internet. And I think interpersonal violence is probably one of the most important ways that harms are reduced by buying drugs online.
Yeah, that's true. And I also usually don't give my Coke dealer my address.
In New York, you do.
Well, yeah. Delivery, you do. Okay, fair enough. Yeah. So the counterpoint to that would be, so people are putting their wellness at risk in different ways, but not necessarily eliminating the risk. They're shifting the risk to one of, if I have a dispute with this vendor and they have my address, they could SWAT me, they could call in a hostage situation at my address, or they could call in a tip to the local drug hotline and say, you just might find, 20,000 Xanax in this person's shoebox, which generally the person who you're buying from in a face-to-face market, they might not have access to that information. And the other counterpoint that I would say is that does mitigate the risk at the buyer level, but not in upstream production markets. So the fact that I'm not going to get, robbed or, jumped or whatever in the process of going to buy drugs doesn't change the fact that, that farms are getting burned in Bolivia. And so we can, reduce the risk from ourselves, which is important. I think, but maybe not in other parts of the supply chain.
So, but maybe, you talked about the candy, the bakery, right? Mm-hmm. And there are lots of, you can buy other things on the dark nets. You can buy stolen art, you can buy fake prescriptions, guns, you can buy pretty much any physical thing that can be shipped in the mail. So there are places where you can't get naloxone for reversing overdoses. You can't get buprenorphine or methadone for drug treatment. I think an example that we were talking about earlier in China, there's no access to hepatitis C medications, but 100,000 people in China have bought hepatitis C medications online and taken it to treat themselves. So getting access to medications that are hard to get, it's a great thing that these markets can provide.
Yeah, and that's absolutely wonderful. I love to see when people are getting naloxone in communities that don't otherwise have it, when people have access to, say, contraceptives or steroids or hormones they might otherwise not be able to access in their community. One of my primary concerns there is not necessarily the supply chain, but maybe the cold chain or the light chain or the proper storage of those substances through that process, or their authenticity in that, through that chain, where they might not, some of these products are less stable than others. So perhaps if it's a pill, and if that pill was actually made by the person who claims to have made it and actually contains the active ingredient that it claims to contain, then that's an absolutely wonderful situation, I think, where people can access means for wellness that they might not otherwise be able to get.
And I think that's especially when we're trying to, when we're thinking of where the dark nets can go beyond the kind of user base in Europe, in North America, and a hand, you know, pockets of other places, using these conduits for money and product, for bringing medicines that have that are needed for other life-saving purposes in other parts of the world where those medicines are not available. This could be a viable alternative to consider.
So, but can I pose one problem or question? You know,
all right. Sure.
So, you know, working in direct services, you know, say in, you know, be it in San Francisco or in Portland or in Boston, you know, occasionally I'll have somebody walk up to me and show me their phone and say like, "Hey, look at this listing. Isn't this cool?" And you know, they're looking at a market, you know, on their smartphone. But you know, what is the, you know, like what's the real impact of these markets? Like, you know, for me in that role, you know, when I'm, you know, doing direct services and trying to help people face to face.
Yeah, and I think that plays out different ways in different locations, right? So this is a great place to get knowledge about what drugs are out there, what forms they're in. You can find out if a particular, you know, if someone comes up to you with a pill that doesn't look right, you know, the edges are not sharp and maybe the writing on it looks a little funky, you can find that particular pill online. You might find discussions saying like, "Oh yeah, this counterfeit version of this pill is being circulated in this community or in this city or in this region." And you can, you know, you can line it up and look at and see, kind of identify things that way. The people who are working in direct service provision have also kind of encountered people who are selling product online who are looking for, say, naloxone to package with with heroin that they're shipping. And
customers who bought this also liked that.
Yes, exactly. You may also want to consider, and some of it is packaged with the heroin or the fentanyl or the pills, and some of it is you have to buy the naloxone separately. And those are, you know, specific things that do happen, and you know, throughout the country.
So, look, there's a lot to say, and maybe at this point we should just stop and open it up to some questions, and maybe let's take a few questions, and then we'll try to group them. And if you wouldn't mind speaking into the microphone, and it's here on a stand. Allison, will we run it around to people, or should they approach? Okay, so, yeah, if you wouldn't mind approaching the microphone, and... also, if I could ask people to keep their questions relatively brief, since I know our speakers have a lot to say and there may be a number of questions.
Yeah, my question is, I'm very surprised with your tone. You are very sympathetic to these markets. Do you get paid by these markets or these drug makers for all the publicity you are making tonight?
No, not at all. you know, if I could get paid in crypto, it'd be a lot better than cash. So I think my tone is a little bit irreverent, and I think that largely comes from an experience of like understanding that I kind of see the markets as an inevitability. The confluence of technologies and sort of consumer expectations that we have led us to a point where people want to be able to buy something. We have the means to create these sort of markets, and attempts to stop the markets from happening have been, I think, you know, futile and counterproductive. You know, the markets have been sort of hardened and strengthened over time in terms of the development of new technologies. And so my take on them is not one of like, you know, pearl clutching horror. It's one of like trying to be constructive and engage the people who buy, use, sell, and make drugs in a conversation about how to do that in a way that harms people the least or not at all or benefits them.
And I think every major interdiction effort has led, you know, there have been major interdiction efforts that have led to the shutdown of markets and to the disruption of supply chain, to the supply. And those things have in turn kind of led to more encryption, more hidden services, more kind of pushing things underground. And at the end of the day, is that the right cycle to address the fundamental reasons why people are using drugs and what the harms are? I think that's part of the question that's worth exploring.
Yes, please. And panelists, don't respond to each question, because let's take a bunch and then okay. we'll respond.
Hi, thanks for all that. My name is Joanne Chud. I teach at Columbia University. I think that people are being prosecuted for crimes of this nature, and I just wonder if you could say something about the nature of the law and whether there are legislative developments that we should expect. It seems to me that the prosecutions have called on a number of different bodies of criminal law, and is this going to help in, is this going to eventually to have the effect of tightening drug laws at a moment when we hope for reform?
Hi, I'm Sheila Vicaria. So my question is, there's a lot of benefits to this kind of a market, right? You can be an informed consumer, there's a degree of possible safety and protection, but it's also exclusive, right, in terms of access. And one of the things that we're trying to reconcile in cannabis legalization is the same thing, right? It incentivizes high stakes players, people who have a lot of money and resources and the ability to protect themselves and insulate themselves. So how do we talk about equality and access and information and being a knowledgeable consumer and those kinds of things?
I'm Ash Kalb. I'm disclaimer, one of the founders of a company that hunts bad botnets on the internet. So the fundamental feature.
Sorry, Ash, could you just explain something about what that means for those of us who don't understand?
I'm one of the co-founders of White Ops. When you hear people in the news talk about Russian botnets spamming people's accounts or the ones that can tell they aren't real people. But part of what's allowed that economic sector to explode over the past 5 or 6 years is the fact that the darknet marketplaces allow people to have reputation without identity. And that's, for me, the fundamental characteristic of a darknet marketplace. You can have like an eBay score without having it linked to a personal identity, which when there are regulatory and legal roadblocks to transactions that absolutely should happen, is great. But it also is the same space in which transactions that, and we can all put our moral barometer wherever we want to, but at some point, probably most of the people in the room don't want people to be able to transact in plastic explosives anonymously with cryptocurrency. So I guess my question is, as somebody whose job is somewhat to regulate this market, and not regulate it, but regulate it in terms of the companies that provide access to it, how do I, without subscribing to any general morality, any legal morality, any external value system, how do I figure out what is something I should care about as bad and what I shouldn't care about? Because hearing the example of by this and also the heroin, right? Like it's a good anecdote because we all recognize that that's bad. But like, okay, no, I'm with you there too. I'm not allowed to have political positions, but I am in a role where I actually have to tell large internet companies which things to allow and which things not to allow. And I'm the major policymaker in that position. And I don't know what to do, because I want the extra governmental marketplaces to exist. I also don't want to be part of the problem.
Yeah.
All right, cool. So you want to do that?
So we have, the quality of information and access. We have the question of laws, and we have the question of an unregulated, like quality control and ethics in an unregulated marketplace, and like, what do we do?
Yeah, there's a lot to chew on there.
It's going to be my call if it's not something that we all decide together.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll talk about it. So from the prosecution standpoint, like the legal environment, I definitely want to touch on that real quick. So people have definitely been prosecuted for vending products on these markets. There have been some manslaughter and murder charges that have been brought against people who have supplied products that have resulted in overdose deaths. There are also people who are living in cages because they've sold drugs on the internet, and that happens as well. What I see as the most interesting sort of implication for sort of law and public policy is the opportunity to evaluate the effects of interventions. Maybe this plays across both the first and the third questions. When we see that somebody is that there's this new product on the market, and there's a concerted effort to try and stop that. The markets, in their transparency, offer an opportunity for us to see what happens. Are there substitutions of an old product for a new market? For a new product. So when we just saw a couple of new substances added to the to Schedule One. Are those going to disappear on the markets? Are they just going to be relabeled on the markets? And so I see it as a useful tool for the evaluation of interventions, to understand, like, do these things actually move the needle? Like, are you just chasing, the bots down a rabbit hole with no actual effect on public health and safety? Or are we doing the same in our federal drug policies? So I think as an opportunity to sort of investigate and challenge the sort of intents of public policy versus their effects, that's where they'll be most useful.
Right. And at the kind of intersection of Joanne's question and Sheila's question, the transactions that are happening online are a minuscule fraction of all the drug transactions that are happening at any given point, at any point in the world. And I won't even begin to try to give you how many decimal points after the percent that would be.
For the moment.
But the point being that the interaction between the kind of established drug markets, the established cartels, the established interdiction efforts and surveillance methods with the crypto markets, there's the regulation and laws around the crypto markets are almost a small subset, almost so heavily informed by the bigger body of regulation and policing that it's almost inseparable from them. An example of this would be in China. So there were research. So one type of crypto market vendor is called a research chemical manufacturer. So these are the actual factories, physical plants where the raw materials that are not controlled substances get turned into controlled substances and sold as powder. And those research chemicals are used for, research purposes by a lot of legitimate industries, if you're making a new pesticide or something like that, right? But those also have been shipping different configurations of things that look like fentanyl to the United States, right? So this was something that was pretty well documented by US, South American, Canadian authorities and kind of brought to the attention of Chinese authorities. And the Chinese authorities had a substantial crackdown on some of the known research chemical manufacturers. And that led to that particular chemical structure of a fentanyl analog being kind of disappearing from the market and being replaced by two or three other similar but slightly different chemical structures. And the manufacturers closed down shop in this province and moved to this province and opened up again. And we can actually trace all of this online. And so I think so in those kinds of situations, it wasn't just that the fentanyl was coming from the crypto market, it was being sold online, but it was also being sold through cartel-based distribution and kind of traditional systems. So I think there is this constant interplay between the two that's going to continue.
Although let me press you a little bit, and it picks up on Ash's question, but even on the first question, right, which is, you know, you can buy, you know, obviously child sexual exploitation and, you know, explosives and these things. You know, one of the arguments, for example, for cannabis regulation, say, it has been segmenting the market and basically allowing people to buy a less harmful substance and not basically moving them out of the bakery, saying like, okay, we're only going to sell bread, not cake, and that will be better for you. Is there like an ethics? Like, are some companies better than others? Is there some moral system that some people have articulated that says we're going to do this, but we're not going to do that? Like Sheila was playing the market. There are a lot of different ways to play it, right? Are some people playing it more morally than others?
Yeah, they have different policies and different motivations for those policies. So, you know, some of the markets say no weapons, and, you know, no child sexual exploitation materials. And some of them do that because they feel those are morally abhorrent. And some of them do that because they don't want to catch the attention of the people who are out hunting the people who do those things. So sometimes it's out of self-preservation, and sometimes it's out of a sort of value position or principle or virtue. So, you know, certainly. And, you know, there are also places that, you know, some markets cap the volumes of product that can be transacted. So rather than being able to buy, you know, kilos of alprazolam, you can only buy, you know, a mere 500 grams. And, you know, with the intention to, you know, being that they don't want to flatten the supply chain too much. They don't want to make it too easy for, you know, a random person to, you know, start moving kilos of product through their community.
My biggest concern is that if you could see through all the sock puppets.
You probably have to use the microphone. But.
Can I speak to another element of what Sheila was saying?
Yeah.
I think that's really important, the question of access. So a lot of times, you know, when I'm thinking about these, and I was initially introduced to these markets through, like, bourgeois technophilic drug exploration, you know, and, like, that's... Yeah, that's where I'm coming from.
That's how you roll.
Yeah. Oh, quite literally. But that is, I think, the sort of, well, I wouldn't seek to characterize the average person because other studies have done that. There's some great articles. There's a 2016 special edition of the International Journal of Drug Policy that's all about crypto markets, and there's some excellent research, you know, like interviews that have been done with people who use crypto markets about who they are and why they're using and what they're doing. But, you know, on the other hand, crypto markets aren't just retail operations. And I think the framing them as supply chains, what Nab and I tried to do in our recent paper was to frame them as supply chains. And I think that has an important implication when it comes to access. If crypto markets have protective factors, then yes, there's a certain amount of digital literacy required to access them. But people are using drugs that flow through crypto markets without their knowledge many times. Like, you know, there's a story in the paper about somebody who was importing fentanyl from China to Salt Lake City, where they were pressing it into counterfeit Roxy's and then sending them, you know, 10,000 at a time to a person in Portland, Oregon, who was selling them on the streets of Portland. When I moved to Portland a couple of months ago, I was given the impression by some people that there was not a fentanyl problem in Portland. And this just simply wasn't a thing that was happening. Because A, maybe those people weren't coming into the exchange programs, and B, they weren't testing for fentanyl in their medical examiner reports. But that's all to say that, like, the drugs that flow through the markets And the people who use them and are impacted by them shouldn't be conflated with the people who directly purchase on the markets. And I think that's an important point to make. But also, if there are protective factors in the form of information about drugs, especially about emerging drugs and, you know, things that people can do to mitigate the risk, say, of using fentanyl, like how to prepare a nasal spray if you don't want to be injecting every 2 hours or if you don't want to develop a certain tolerance at a certain rate, the current tools that we have, the current means that people have to do that is to pour through whatever click path they take through the internet. And that is going to be, that's going to change depending on their sort of their priors technologically and culturally. And it's going to depend on like how much time they have and where they happen to go. So I think, you know, there are opportunities around the development of tools to help people, essentially help people to understand the wisdom of the crowd that's being sort of coalesced within these communities and translating that to people who don't necessarily have the time or inclination to spend hours pouring through drip reports on the internet.
I know you have the microphone. Before you go, though, okay. I want to ask if other people have questions since you've already had a chance. Please.
But
there's a mic there. There's a mic right in front of you. Thanks.
I myself bought Valium through internet. I don't need a doctor's prescription. I just ordered it, and it was very cheap. It came from Pakistan or something. Mm-hmm. And there's no regulation. It's easy. I need Valium. I would just order. And so that was so easy. And so young kids are putting like a codeine in a sweet, you know, bubbly drink and put candy and they have a heart attack kind of thing. And it's happening a lot. That's why I came here. And second thing is like, now everybody talking about why I didn't buy a Bitcoin. I was like, if I bought a Bitcoin, it's not traceable, right? I mean, it's very hard to trace, I heard. So if I want to buy a bunch of LSD with Bitcoin, is it possible to do it?
That's a categorical.
It's
a categorical yes. It's possible. The question is whether you can do so anonymously. There are elements of operation of what we're referred to as OPSEC or operational security that help you to separate your real life identity from your online persona or from your, you know, from your wallet address. To the first question, I think it's absolutely worth recognizing that a lot of people who buy drugs on the internet don't use crypto markets. And it's frankly pretty easy. Go on like Twitter right now and look at people selling Xanax bars.
For your inbox.
Yeah, you'll find a lot. And so, you know, crypto markets certainly don't have, you know, I don't know what proportion of the online drug trade occurs through here, through those systems, but they facilitate the sort of protection of people's liberty in the process of pursuing whatever states they're seeking with drug consumption.
So to kind of take that a little further, the questions, the drugs that you can buy from online pharmacies that are kind of in the regular internet tend to ship Schedule 3 and 4 substances. So that means things like Valium are definitely included, and codeine and tramadol are kind of the controlled substances, the most common. When people order something stronger, like an oxycodone or even a hydrocodone, what they get in the mail from Pakistan or from wherever else is usually just codeine or something of a lesser potency. So, you know, they got scammed when they made that purchase. That's not to say that that's a sufficient regulation for this for that phenomenon, but the U.S. Postal Service has had multiple kind of efforts to do different kind of ambient drug testing of packages that go through the mail. There's been kind of experiments to understand to detect kind of the more potent chemicals that get transferred. So the private package carriers, UPS and FedEx, all have specific policies and other testing things that they do that are not widely reported and maybe not widely done, not to every shipment. You know, it's all the volume of of packages is so high that you're never going to get to 100% interdiction on that. But that's a good question.
And to the question about Bitcoin and anonymity or protection of identity, I have noticed in the rhetoric around when sites are closed or when anonymized email servers are taken down, a lot of discussion of freedom, anti-censorship, like people referring to these markets as, you know, genuinely free and these efforts as anti-censorship. And so a lot of invocation of sort of American libertarian traditions reflect.
Yeah. So, you know, that was, I think, like most prominently instilled in the community by the writings from the Dred Pratt Roberts on the original Silk Road forums, where there was a lot of sort of libertarian anarcho-capitalist ideology frankly, was as important, I think, politically or philosophically within the development of the technology and the community to the harm reduction stuff. Like, I want to be clear. Like, I don't think that anybody necessarily built these markets with the explicit purpose of harm reduction. Liberty was definitely at the top of the priorities.
Or was it money that was at the top of the priorities?
Well, yeah. The money didn't hurt. I guess it didn't. But you know, it's also
it's the same thing.
All right.
Yeah. You know, yeah, but you can't spend your money if you're living in a cage. You know, just ask Ross.
Yeah. So, Ash, do you still have the microphone or no?
Oh, no.
You gave it up. Yeah, and then,
Anybody before me, I'm boring.
Thank you. A couple years ago, I read an article in New York Times magazine about one guy who had very modest way of life, living very simple condition, apartment, but he become multi-millionaire and bunch of people work for him, and after they began to do same what he did, and he did approximately what you spoke about now. And he hired assassin to kill a couple of these people to give a lessons. FBI agent who was involved in this case, when he saw how easy to make $1 million and he worked something for 70,000 per year, he began do the same. So how it comes that you have not this temptation to do the same?
And I should clarify that our colleagues are not actually running crypto markets. They just know a lot about them and sound like they could, but that's not their role.
I don't even own Bitcoin.
Yeah. I mean, frankly, I'll leave that to other people who are way more technically talented and sort of risk, accepting than I. If I did it, I would be like horribly self-flagellating about whether I was doing it in the absolute perfect way at all times, and that would be a nightmare.
I have a question. We've talked a little bit about the possibility for harm reduction, sort of more endogenously to these markets, but do you see an opportunity to infiltrate or capitalize for people who are not buying or selling drugs, but more interested in public health promotion, harm reduction?
Yeah, absolutely. There's some really great sort of predicates for that, like Fernando Caravilla, who runs Energy Control, drug checking service based in Barcelona. He kind of held court on the Silk Road forums and in other places thereafter. There are several other people who have done that and provided, you know, information to people to help them answer questions. There are other groups like, you know, there are all these reviews that are associated with the markets now that may not all be making it to the places where they used to be, and used to be kind of sounds like a grand statement, but, you know, places like Arrowhead or, other places where people used to gather blue light, where people talk about their experiences with drugs, having a sort of curatorial function, you know, and frankly, if there are tools that can use a sort of digital assist to help distill the wisdom of the crowd and feed it back to people who are seeking it, that's useful. And then it's also an incredible forum for understanding information-seeking behaviors. Like, people ask questions, and knowing what the questions are is extremely useful. Characterizing, like, what, you know, when new products emerge, what do people do to keep themselves safe? And how can we understand and, you know, and share that information, I think is useful. And then there are other things around like helping people maintain their liberty. Like, you know, one of the simplest functions from, you know, a website that is just very recently defunct, provided a service that gave the public a key, the sort of encryption key that vendors had posted over time, and helped people to verify those, you know, in a sort of provably historical context, so that when they went to send somebody a message, they either knew this is their key or this has been signed by their old key, so that you're not talking to the police officer sitting over their shoulder. So there are functions that are both informational and technical that I think can help people sort of navigate the, you know, the environment.
So I see some people at the microphone here, Heidi, and I see some hands awaiting a microphone. So let's go to the person at the microphone first, and then.
Hi. Do you know if the recent market fluctuations in cryptocurrency have affected the market? Like, have people been hoarding or trying to flash sell real fast? And do you think that will have any impact on the long-term stability of these types of markets?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the way that the fluctuations, so the what she's referring to is that the cryptocurrencies, these digital currencies, have increased in value, you know, as steep a line as you can draw, and for some of the major ones, and then smaller currencies have kind of, each with their own flavor and doing things a little differently, have also emerged, and those have kind of increased. And there's kind of a whole kind of cottage industry and offering new coin products, basically, new types of money, which is not very, you know, different from like when Visa and MasterCard and credit cards came on the market, it became popular. So it's very much the same kind of conceptual process. So the fluctuations have been very extreme, and there are people who have made kind of mind-boggling amounts of money. By all estimates, the number of people who have benefited from that is very, very small. You know, it's less than 10% of all the people who hold this currency have kind of had this substantial increase in their online wealth, at least. So the way that the markets are responding, you know, you see price fluctuations, but even like within a transaction, the price could also have changed by the time someone hands the coin to the market and it gets sent to the vendor. So there are kind of agreed on rules for some of that. But I think, you know, what is, so I'll give you an anecdote of someone who lives here in New York, and she had been a Bitcoin speculator and just kind of out of boredom just did it, and then made a ton of Bitcoin and decided she needed to spend it and didn't really want to kind of bring it into cash because she didn't want it to be traced back to her. Okay, so she's thought, okay, what can I use this for? And so she went, you know, she said, okay, well, I guess I can buy drugs. She wasn't particularly like a drug user, you know, wasn't like some, that wasn't like a big a piece of her identity. But what she ended up doing was finding, she had a very kind of difficult mental health condition that was what she found effectively treated by an unregulated medication that was available online, which was grown, you know, comes from Africa and isn't available in the United States. And she found this to be like a very therapeutic thing. So, but at the same time, you can see how that kind of, you know, it goes back to the bakery and, mm-hmm. and cakes problem as well. So I think the fluctuations are changing the markets, but I think it's also changing people's behaviors as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's take two more questions, and then, or three more questions, and then we'll bring it to a close.
Real quick, yeah, my question is there a consolidated effort right now in the dark web to push the harm reduction movement as a coalition, to gather people together and say, okay, we're going to step out of anonymity. I'm going to step out and in the United States, and I'm going to step out in Europe, and I'm going to step out in South Africa, whatever. And we're going to gather these anonymous people, we're going to contact them, and we're going to tell them, let's promote a message. Safe method, whatever. We come mm-hmm. to a conclusion, we get all the groups together, we do all this nonsense that gets done, that needs to get done to get people to get an idea. Is someone doing that right now?
Thanks. Don't answer yet. Let's go to the last two questions and then.
Yeah. No, I think my question was along the same lines, in that I was thinking there's one thing to bring harm reduction to the dark net, And there's also to bring the dark nets harm reduction out onto the streets, mm-hmm. which I was also thinking, like, are there, and you come from this public health orientation, are there practices that we can learn from the market and pull out for larger public health interventions around anonymity, around the kinds of information that people share, why they find these spaces, mm-hmm. unique spaces to be able to interact, safe spaces in some ways, mm-hmm. and bring that into the public health efforts. And I think that would be a much different way to think about these markets, to not try to necessarily turn them into something that they refuse to be, but to really take the elements of them and to exploit that for the benefits of public health.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry, one more question.
I'm so excited by these questions.
It's here, just behind Joanna.
Thank you. My question was, is there like a common profile of the market administrators, the buyers, the sellers? Because I would more or less think that it would be more organized crime organizations that actually could use this with to full ability, because there seems to be a high level of risk. And like you were saying earlier, most people they would need kind of was going to be tech savvy to actually kind of use the dark net to access it. And I know from just being on a college campus, you know, a lot of people just use Snapchat or use Twitter to buy most of their drugs or scammers for their papers or anything like that.
Yeah, I can start with that one. I mean, I think we will. I mean, I think it's, I don't know, I would go out on a limb and predict that we will see a cartel-based crypto market emerge in the next couple of years. And I don't know that that's a good thing, but I don't know kind of, you know, and I think we already see we've already observed specific examples of cartel players interacting with the crypto market. So a very quick example from Quebec.
Oh yeah.
Yes. Was someone who was a cartel distributor in Canada and had been incarcerated and was actually continuing to sell cartel-based drugs through the crypto market from the prison computer. And so there was, you know, so there are like specific examples that we can point to that we know. We also see on the crypto markets people kind of selling cartel-branded products. So like Sinaloa heroin, for example, you can search for and ostensibly purchase, you know, drugs that were produced or at least distributed by certain cartels, if that's the nature of what you're looking for. So I think it's I don't know. It's kind of, in terms of like the moral barometer, that's kind of where things start feeling not so good.
But how about the questions about the good? Either getting people together in the same way that harm reduction advocates used to find dealers who would be willing to distribute naloxone or provide clean needles. Like, is there some movement, organized movement, to actually separate out people, I don't know, marketeers of conscience or who are willing to do something? Or the other question, which is, what can we learn from the dark web about how to actually talk to people about things that they want to talk about that they can't talk about mm-hmm. on the clear web?
So, yeah, I think there may be at least two parts of the question that you asked that I want to touch on. One is, you know, are these online communities translating into face-to-face, boots on the ground, organizing, you know, for political change, social change? The answer to that, I would say, is unfortunately no. Primarily because people come to these markets and they use them partly, perhaps largely, because of the pseudonymity that they provide. Because, you know, they can, they're there for their own purposes, mostly, you know, to buy or sell something. And they don't want to connect their identity, you know, their meat space identity with that digital, you know, identity. So there's not a lot of like, let's get together and let's meet. There is a lot of discussion and promotion of harm reduction sort of as a set of sort of ideas and practices. Like, referring to harm reduction within the markets is seen as a very virtuous thing. Saying that somebody is practicing harm reduction is like seen as great praise. And it's also something that people do to signal virtue and to as a perhaps as a market differentiator and perhaps as a example, you know, to others. Actually, I think I have a couple of slides that I prepared, and I just want to show one because it sort of illustrates this almost exactly. So this is a listing from yesterday for 56 grams of number 4 gray or tan heroin from Off to Brick. Off to Brick sort of made a bit of a splash recently when they started selling, as you see, you probably can't read it down there, free fence strip included with every order. Be safe out there. So they're sending fentanyl test strips along with their number 4. You know, if I'm in Boston and, you know, the market is saturated there, this person is offering to sell me some number 4 that, along with the means to confirm the absence of fentanyl in it.
And crudely. Customer ratings from his previous customers saying that he's
right. Yeah. And there are markets that have waived vendor bonds for people who are willing to sell things like naloxone. The Alpha Bay market, you know, Trappy was one of the sort of front-facing customer reps, you know, or, you know, admins, who made it a policy that if you sold naloxone products, you could get, you know, bonds and commissions waived. So there are incentives to, you know, to perform these practices. And to your question about, like, do we try to promote harm reduction within the markets or learn, like, what's the directionality of learning and teaching? I would learn a lot. I love the opportunity to learn from people who buy, use, and sell drugs about their experiences on all sides of those equations, because we get to see such quick iteration of new strategies. You know, you get to see things like, you know, LSD vendors who are also including Xanax bars with their products, so that if people have an uncomfortable experience, they can cool out a little bit. And that, you know, establishes a best practice. I know people who didn't know that that was a thing until they saw it on the internet. And we can learn a lot of other ways, like, you know, the evolution of, like, new form factors for drugs. Like, you know, fentanyl's pretty hard to dose if you're getting it in a raw form, which most people aren't. They're getting it cut with Incitol or mannitol or whatever, you know, whatever else. But you can, if you have a relatively pure, you know, product, you can mix it with, you know, a buffer with a liquid, make it into a nasal spray with, like, a specific, you know, 100 microgram per pump dose. You can put it onto blotter and administer it sublingually. And if you're trying to, like, go to work and not be sick and not nod and not get caught going off to the bathroom every so often, those are really interesting practices that I never heard anybody else talking about at any of the harm reduction conferences I went to before a year ago, you know? And so I learned it from the internet, from people who buy, use, sell, make, you know, and so forth drugs. And I think that's where we can learn a lot from people, learning about the emergence of new drugs, new form factors.
I think, but just to temper it a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I think there's the path from the experimentation online with new form factors, new anything, to getting to the actual street level, to kind of what most people who use drugs experience. I think there is still kind of derivative steps that happen there, which we will, you know, where some of this experimentation may catch on in a particular location, particular person or whatever, and won't kind of become the new norm. On the other hand, we've also seen in online world in general that a particular new idea can catch on and become, you know, pervasive in society before we even know it. So monitoring the trends and watching and kind of seeing what does catch on, I think, is very useful to know kind of, and to see, you know, connecting that. I find, like, everything online needs to be connected with something on the ground. And so seeing what you see online and asking people, hey, have you seen a fentanyl nasal spray? Have you seen this happening here? You know, and kind of talking, you know, if you're doing direct service, then having, you know, connecting those dots, I think is going to be useful for everyone.
And to build on that too, you know, I think sometimes people don't know what they want until they see it. And in the case of a lot of, like, emerging drugs or in these markets, It's not prescriptive, like, oh, we saw this here. Everybody should be doing this. It's not like I'm going to go, you know, it's not like I'm going to tell somebody across the table, you know, at an outreach site, like, you should be putting your methadrone in a vape, you know, or whatever. But it's an option, you know, and if that person is, you know, if their sinuses are infected and they're used to insufflating, you know, whatever their drug of choice, and there are other options, then we can learn a lot. And there are innovations coming out from or being discussed in the markets that I think provide an uncommon window that, frankly, I think gives us a really good argument for working with people who use drugs every single day in every possible way that we can. Because look how much we can learn just from the internet, just from this like weird distorted mirror that we have to hold up to society. Like if we actually talk to people directly, we can learn a whole lot. And I think that's where it's valuable.
Yeah, thank you. I think we'll actually stop there. I know that, Ash, I'm going to invite you to come up to approach the bench after because I can tell even from the first part of your question that it may be technologically beyond some of us in the audience. But thank you all for coming, and thank you guys. I neglected to mention that our speakers have come from Portland and North Carolina, respectively, just for tonight. So really greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.